Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Kentuckians, get ready to soar.
Folks in the region are desperate and know we need to build a better, stronger economy that works.
A new book by photographer Builder Levy documents changes in the coal fields.
Your beautiful Appalachian mountains, and especially in central Appalachia where the mountains are stark and steep.
A Tucker County, West Virginia clock repairman marks his 90th birthday.
You know, I've got to figure out everything. I never go to sleep between 3 and 4 o'clock every morning because I got things on my mind.
And the West Virginia Music Hall of Fame loses a member.
They grew up in a very hardscrabble home. Their mother had to raise them.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Leaders in Kentucky are making a bipartisan effort to solve the economic woes in the state's Appalachian region. On Monday, a conference known as SOAR, which stands for Shaping Our Appalachian Region, takes place in Pikeville. WMMT's Sylvia Ryerson reports in this preview that some folks have high hopes the conference will lead to solutions.
Over 1,500 people have registered to attend the upcoming conference titled SOAR, Shaping Our Appalachian Region, taking place Monday, December 9th at the Eastern Kentucky Expo Center in Pikeville. There's a lot of interest and expectation, as well as uncertainty about what the outcomes may be. WMMT spoke to a few individuals who are concerned about the region's future, about what their hopes are for the SOAR event. Justin Maxson is president of the Mountain Association for Community Economic Development, known as MACID, and was appointed to the 41-person planning committee that is organizing the event.
Eastern Kentucky's lost more than 6,000 coal jobs in the last 2 years, and, that's a huge negative impact. Folks in the region are desperate and know we need to build a better, stronger economy that works better for more people. And I think there's a lot of frustration in the region right now where folks know that we need leadership from our elected officials who will help us, not do for us, but help us chart a new path.
Bethany Aislinger is 19 and a student at the Southeast Community College in Cumberland, and she feels we're at a critical moment.
In all honesty, I believe everything is at stake. I believe the well-being, jobs, education, and the future, especially for young people, is at stake, mainly because it seems like a lot of people don't want to talk about the hard stuff, you know, about the economy and about coal and everything. And I think that the SOAR conference is something that is really going to help bring this together. And if it gets in the headlines, maybe more people in the community will want to focus and start talking about it, and it'll start initiating conversations among both the older generation and the younger generation as one.
Like Aislinger, Maxson thinks SOAR is a real opportunity and significant in how it is being convened as a bipartisan effort between Democratic Governor Steve Beshear and Republican Congressman Hal Rogers.
I think SOAR matters because it is bringing together, you know, a Democratic governor, a powerful Republican congressman, in response to what is a collapse of the coal industry in the region, and that it provides a focus for a conversation in the region, an event on December 9th in Pikeville. That day isn't going to answer the challenges in front of the region, but it can create a focus for the sort of conversations that need to happen to move longer-term planning and investment process that will be necessary to create new economic opportunities. So SOAR to me matters because it spotlights the need for a different conversation.
Joe DePriest is the Economic Development Director for Letcher County and is on board for moving the conversation and the planning process forward.
I'm just hoping and praying that this thing will accomplish something that will put into motion things that will help our area tremendously in the near future and in the long-term future. We all know a large number of the coal miners have got laid off. The economy went really downhill a few years back for the whole nation, and here about a year, year and a half ago, it hit here. So I do not think this SOAR summit will solve all of our problems. I don't think it'll be a quick fix. I don't think anybody is presenting it that way. But I am thankful that somebody's paying attention, and somebody's saying we do need to get together and think about these things and come up with some kind of plan. I think one big thing is going to be with the outcome of the SOAR summit, as they call it, will be people working together in different counties, different regions, try to bring together, instead of us all trying to do our own thing as a small community, trying to work together as a team, as a region. Eastern Kentucky is a region.
Over the past decade, DePriest has worked hard to recruit new businesses to locate in Letcher County. But in recent years, he has found this increasingly difficult.
I think the big challenge, the single challenge, if I had to sort of prioritize them, would be just the lack of leads the last few years. In other words, the first 3 or 4 years we had the park going, it seemed like that was before the big downturn in the nation, and we had a lot of leads, and we had a lot of what we call success. We got close to 300 jobs there at the Gateway Park in a few short years, about seven different companies. And but now with the downturn in the economy, we've lost a lot of those. We're down to less than 100 jobs in the park right now. And my biggest single challenge over the last few years has been a lack of leads. In other words, companies not really considering relocating, companies not really considering expanding, companies not really wanting to invest money, whatever it might be, hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars in new startups. On top of that, we do have some challenges in the county as far as our broadband, access to broadband in different parts of the county. There's some challenges there. And I'm open to suggestions. I'll say that. I'm open to suggestions. And I think most of the leadership in Letcher County is.
Justin Maxson hopes SOAR will be the beginning of a long-term process that takes a new approach to job creation and community improvement in Eastern Kentucky.
I am concerned that SOAR could lift up what we need to do is a lot more industrial recruitment and spend more money and more subsidies on that end instead of investing in strategies that build local enterprises and local entrepreneurial activities. So, I have concern that unless SOAR creates a vision or helps the region create a vision of what we want, we'll get a bunch of development that may look better than what we have today, but isn't actually going to be what people want. So in a day event, there's just not much space to do any of it. So I think we have to push it into a longer process that allows us to create a vision, a set of criteria, some options that a permanent body could use to then really do the hard work to figure out what's going to work. Economic development is really hard. I think we have to have a vision. We have to have good, strong processes. We need professional staff people to help. And we have to make sure SOAR doesn't just promote any job as a good job, but that SOAR promotes building jobs that create opportunity and build a stronger, better, more diverse, and sustainable economy.
As a young person from here, Aislinger looks forward to being a part of figuring out the region's future.
For the longest time, being a youth in Northern Kentucky and growing up here my entire life, all I wanted to do was get away and to leave it behind and not have to deal with it and just go to a place where I felt there were more opportunities because I felt there was nothing here. But as I've gotten older and I've gotten more involved in my community, I've realized that there's a lot that we can actually put into it and that this could be a really good place to start out. And especially with a career like journalism for me, bringing awareness to the kind of topics that we don't want to talk about and I just think that there's a lot of potential that Harlan County and other southeastern Appalachian communities have. I think it's going to take a lot of, you know, community involvement. Hopefully the leaders in our communities, like at City Hall and different things like that, they'll want to talk about this stuff and to participate in interviews and board meetings that can discuss these things and make it okay to discuss these things. And I think if corporations heard about it that were in renewable energy and wanted to try and do experiments and put their piece or their mark on a place like Harlan that is struggling because of the reliance on coal, I think that that would be a great thing, too. It's just going to take a lot of talk, you know, events like SOAR and stuff like that to kind of get it going. But I believe once it gets going that there's a lot of great things that's going to happen.
The SOAR event will take place Monday, December 9th at the East Kentucky Expo Center in Pikeville. Pre-registration has closed, but there will be on-site registration. Everyone that shows up on Monday will be able to attend. Reporting for WMMT in Whitesburg, I'm Sylvia Ryerson.
One economic solution some in Kentucky see is building a natural gas liquids pipeline, a project some oppose. One such group, Kentuckians United to Restrain Eminent Domain, want to know whether the practice can be used to build the pipeline and has filed a lawsuit to find out. Kentucky Public Radio's Erica Peterson reports.
The Bluegrass Pipeline would build 500 miles of new pipeline across Kentucky and Ohio to carry natural gas liquids from gas fracking operations. Now, a group is asking the court to clarify whether the project could invoke eminent domain if landowners in the pipeline's path refuse to grant easements. Experts disagree about whether the pipeline would qualify for eminent domain under state law. Penny Greathouse has been approached by pipeline representatives hoping to purchase an easement on a farm she owns in Franklin County. She says the current uncertainty surrounding the eminent domain issue is a problem for landowners trying to decide whether to grant easements.
We just want a clarification so that it's either yes, they do, or no, they don't.
By filing the lawsuit, the pipeline's opponents are hoping to get the law clarified before a landowner ends up in court over the matter. They're hoping for a decision in January. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Erica Peterson.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. A clinical study at the University of Kentucky will investigate a cholesterol-lowering drug that could prevent Alzheimer's disease. WEKU's Stu Johnson reports.
The study will look to see if the fibrate class of medicines also work to improve brain health. Fibrates are commonly used to reduce a patient's triglyceride levels. Greg Jica, who's clinical director at UK's Alzheimer's Disease Center, says it's thought fibrates could cut the risk of developing the Alzheimer's disease in half.
We think that the medicine will stand its best chance if we catch any memory or thinking changes, any early signs of Alzheimer's, long before a diagnosis of Alzheimer's would actually be made.
The clinical trial could determine if fibrates improve the heart health of patients as well as their brain health. While common in Europe, there are side effects. Although relatively rare, fibrates can cause muscle pain, liver damage, and gallstones when used for several years. Jica says a call is going out for individuals over 65 with normal memory. He expects just over 70 people will participate in the year-long trial. The Alzheimer's specialist admits it would probably be a few years before results are known. For WEKU News, I'm Stu Johnson.
Students at a Charleston, West Virginia high school are building a satellite. It will be launched into space by NASA on a Soyuz rocket sometime next year. The satellite will gather all kinds of data and beam it back to South Charleston High School for 5 years. As West Virginia Public Radio's Beth Voorhees reports, this is what it means to talk about STEM, or science, technology, engineering, and math, and the students are pretty excited about it.
This is Joe Oliver's computer science class. About a dozen students are seated in front of a large computer monitors along the perimeter of the classroom.
Now what are we going to do? We got to figure out how to put the commas in there. So what are we going to do?
Going over a lesson in computer programming.
Yeah, initialize the first part, which is our number. That's the number you enter, divided by 1,000. Why are we dividing by 1,000?
In the center of the classroom, there's a round table where Logan Shomo and Shelby Combs are staring at a laptop, looking at tracking applications for the satellite they're building.
Basically, this is wireless energy harvesting. So it's how we pick up radio transmissions, which we actually already have our radio, like our base, in the school in the engineering room. But this is for a portable
usage. This is for portable tracking, isn't it?
Yes.
We're trying to find more information on it. This specific article is telling us about applications that we're looking to use for the tracking, and we're trying to find the best way to execute these kind of files as well as the best way to track it.
We're reading up to make sure that we can do everything properly and in a short amount of time so that way we don't have to spend a ton of time debugging.
What is BCC?
These students are building a CubeSat. The name denotes nanosatellites, meaning it's very small satellite, as teacher Joe Oliver explains.
The cube is 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters. And we're trying to put a weather station, a gamma ray recorder, so we can measure the sun rays. And then we're going to put a camera on there that will actually send it back to our school.
State education officials, legislators, policymakers all stress that students need to be studying STEM fields today to get tomorrow's jobs. These South Charleston High School students know what the term means and are delving into all of the STEM fields to design and build this small satellite.
There's no way that we're not getting that. Like, that's our everyday life is definitely part of the STEM program.
Jamie Stover is using the computer skills she developed when she was just a child.
My mom had, like, one of the old Gateway computers, and I'd just sit and mess with it and play paint and stuff on it. Like, that was my life. And she let me do whatever I wanted with it. She taught me how to install programs, and then from there, that's my life.
She's the project's student IT expert. It's her job to troubleshoot any glitches her classroom colleagues have with their computers. One of those colleagues is Tiffany Grigsby. She says she gets a kick out of problem solving.
Because it's a new adventure, like each time you do different things, like one thing doesn't work, then it's like, oh, well, let's go try this thing. And it's a learning process for me. Like, I like to think outside the box and what new things can I try this time, you know what I mean? And I just enjoy thinking and learning what to do next. What do we do now?
But it isn't just these students in Mr. Oliver's computer science classroom that are building and launching this satellite. Oliver explains that this is a school-wide effort.
We have, you know, the English department, the dorm press releases. We have our engineering department. They're helping us design the components to go inside the CubeSat. We have the science and physics department actually figuring out the trajectory of how this is going to launch and where we need to put it and everything. So, you know, potentially we have the whole school involved in this project. So it kind of falls into the STEM and the cross-curriculum activities that students can really, you know, grasp and have something actually hold a real-world working project and application to see how it all comes together and how it works in the real world.
Back to the satellite itself. About half the size of a shoebox, this CubeSat has four long antennae protruding from it. Its exterior will be covered in solar panels.
It's so that way it continues to have power because we can't put a little battery on a satellite and send it up. It's got to have a continuous source of energy, and solar energy is the most reliable and safest, cheapest way to send it up and have it live for a long time.
Logan Shomo and Kenneth Radias explains that it's what's inside the CubeSat that's really important.
We have a device we're going to use to measure the gamma rays. We're going to be measuring solar wind speeds, and then we'll also have a camera that's going to be half inside and
so basically there are like components that we have worked on from this class, and then we're going to put it inside the satellite.
We're going to have to tinker around with
the
exact design because we have to make sure that everything fits, nothing moves around.
Very soon, the students will take their prototype, place it in a special bright orange container similar to a small styrofoam cooler, hitch it to a helium balloon, and send it up for a test drive. The students will be following it from inside vans.
We'll have multiple people in the vans. We'll have somebody who's watching the live feed to visually be able to tell where it's coming down. And then we'll also have the GPS tracker telling us its exact location of where it's going to be landing. And then plus we'll be able to do a little bit of calculation in there and see with wind speed and all that exactly where it'll fall.
South Charleston is the only school in West Virginia with an FCC amateur radio license, which is a requirement to transmit to and control near space and low Earth orbit satellites. Logan explains that sometime next spring, the school will work with NASA to launch it.
First, it has to go through NASA, and they have to measure our payload to make sure that it's not going to mess up the launch. But it'll be going on Soyuz, the Soyuz rocket that'll be launching. And once it gets up there, they'll release it. And whenever it's released, it'll start to track for us, and it'll turn on.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Beth Voorhees in Charleston.
About 40 years ago, a New York photographer named Builder Levy ventured to Appalachia to document life in the coal fields. As Levy traveled the region and got to know its people, he came to love and admire the place. Through a commission from the Appalachian College Association, Levy was able to return between 2002 and 2009 to document the changes that have taken place since he first visited in the late 1960s. The result is a book of photographs and a narrative, Appalachia USA, telling the story of how the coal fields have changed.
You have one of the most beautiful regions in the United States. Your beautiful Appalachian mountains, and especially in central Appalachia, where the mountains are stark and steep, and the most biodiverse region of North America. And at the same time, you have a highly industrialized area, or at the time when I started, through the coal miners. So it's rural, it's industrial, and you have a fantastic heritage of Appalachia, and I knew something about it, and it grew on me.
One section of the book that I found, the whole book fascinating, but one section that was interesting was looking at the social landscape, where you went around and took pictures of various communities. And I was interested in learning what you saw were the similarities between the communities you visited and the differences.
Oh, my God, it's so amazing. Let me just start by saying this. The more I got into different communities in Appalachia and different counties, different hollows even, different towns, the more there was to it, and the more I realized it had so much, I could never really cover everything. And the more I realized I didn't even know. I mean, the more I learned, the more I realized there is to learn. And the more I saw, the more I realized there is to see. And the social landscape, I'm looking through it myself now. And I see I have this beautiful farm landscape, the sheep landscape from out in western Pennsylvania. And at the same time, the industrial town of Ellsworth in western Pennsylvania. I have the little the Kermit, the little group of newsboys that were getting ready to go out on there and distribute their newspapers, or maybe they had just finished, and the little family grouping with them. I went back to Kermit, West Virginia, in one of my, around 2002, because that photograph I made in 1968, it's one of my earliest photographs in this book. And then I went back in 2002 or 2003, and it was gone. I mean, the building in back of it, the structure was gone. It looked different. It was still there, but it was totally changed.
Do you keep in touch? You have some children in there and some minors, and some of them you mentioned have died, but others you don't say what happened to them. Do you keep in touch with the people that we're looking at in the book?
Well, I had gone back and visited this guy, Charlie Blevins, who ran the Red Robin Inn, and that's in my social landscape, a picture of a wall in his Red Robin Inn. And so I visited him again after more than 30 years later. And it was just a month and a half after I visited him, he died of lung complications, and he had black lung when I visited him. He was on a oxygen tank a lot of the time, but he stopped and played one of his banjos and sang a couple of old-time mountain songs for me. So then, in order to get more of his story, I was able to talk with his daughter by phone, and she was so helpful in giving me more of his early life and family life so that I could put it in this book.
There was one person, Toby Moore. He seemed interesting.
Toby Moore, that's a fascinating story. Thank you for asking about him. You see, Toby Moore was the first underground portrait miner that I made a photograph of. It was back in Eastern Coal Company. It was a subsidiary of the large company Pittston. And it was in Stone. The headquarters were in Stone, Kentucky, in Pike County. So I had followed some other miners with their permission one morning from Williamson, West Virginia, over the bridge into Kentucky to get to that mine. And I had no special introduction, no permission. And I just started photographing a little bit on the mine site while miners were waiting for their shift change. One of the foremen, who had become friendly with me, said, "How would you like to go inside?" And of course, I wanted to all the time. I was too shy or hadn't even gotten around to asking, "Can I go in?" And so I said, "Yeah, I'd love to, but I didn't bring a flash." He said, "Okay, we'll provide the lights for you," because I hadn't even expected to get that opportunity at that time. So one Saturday morning, a few days after that conversation, I was inside their mine, the old house branch mine, and this guy, I didn't know his name, this black miner came by. I asked him, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm on my lunch break." And I said, "Could I take your portrait?" He said, "Okay." And I was able to make this guy's portrait. Some 32 years later, because I never got the guy's name. So 32 years later, I was showing a book of my photographs or a portfolio that I had made to Thomas Allen, when I revisited Chatteroy, West Virginia, where I'd spent two summers and staying with a family, the Johnson family. Thomas Allen was one of the few people I found still in the same area on School Street. And so I met him and chatted with him and showed him my photographs. And then when he saw that black miner, he said, "I know that man. He's my friend Toby Moore." And then he proceeded to tell me some of the story, which I have in my book. And it was Toby Moore, his work buddy, they worked together, who convinced Thomas Allen to retire while he still had his health and could enjoy life. And subsequently, of course, Toby Moore had passed away, so I never had the opportunity of meeting him or talking to him again.
Why do you think Toby Moore captures people's attention?
It's unadulterated real. I'm looking at the portrait again, and there were other things that I like about it. It's a very rich photograph in tonalities, and it has a lot of black and has a lot of light and a lot of contrasts and also subtle tones of grays. So it's about photography also. It's about the beauty of photography as well as about the beauty of this man, both the outer beauty and the inner beauty. And it at the same time speaks of an intense life. And that, in effect, is maybe what I'm trying to say, or what I see and I saw in Central Appalachian coal fields of the United States. And maybe it is what I feel about America. Can Toby Moore and can this work be a metaphor for America?
So Donna Muncy, her photograph also attracted me. Here's this 10-year-old girl that you photographed at one point, who's now obviously an adult. And my thought was, what's she like now?
Oh, that's so amazing. Just a regular person. But, you know, we talked about her family. She said, you know, like, well, when they were growing up, they were a family of, I think, five children. And they were a big family. And said we were poor, we didn't have much. But we didn't really think of ourselves as poor because I guess a lot of people were just like them then.
One of the things that struck me about your book from the standpoint of an Appalachian is that it reflects a cultural diversity in this region that a lot of people from the outside just wouldn't see or document.
Yes. Well, that's one of the things that I wanted to go beyond and get past all kinds of stereotypes and get beyond romanticizing or denigrating. I wanted to avoid those pitfalls. And as a photographer artist, I mean, you must, you know, it's easy to fall into those things, either romanticizing, glorifying, or on the other hand, denigrating or looking down or being condescending. And you can do that without even thinking about it if you're not aware of it. And what helps is, for me, what helped is being willing to be open and honest with people and sharing with people what I'm trying to do and being willing to tell them what I'm trying to do and then being willing to talk to them and listen to them and spend time. And for the most part, it worked. And most people were pretty open to me and pretty helpful and allowed me into their lives.
What do you hope people gain from going through the book, perusing the photographs, reading the information you have in it?
Well, I hope they gain a greater understanding of Coalfield and Appalachia, Central Appalachia, understanding it's an important part of American heritage. The meaning of America, you can find it right there in Central Appalachia. The beauty, the heartbreak, and the love, and the desecration, and the intense humanity, and yes, some inhumanity also. So I think that if you look at my book and my photographs, I'm hoping you'll just have a greater appreciation of Appalachia and of America.
Well, Builder Levy, I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
Well, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Appalachia's tight mountains are beloved by many who grew up here, but for some who come from landscapes with less variation, they can be discomforting. That's what essayist Colleen Anderson discovered when the time came to ask her parents to move here.
When my elderly parents moved to a retirement community in West Virginia at my request, it was a tough transition. To lifelong flatlanders, my cherished mountains seemed oppressive, not protective. The roads were narrower and much twistier than those in Michigan. Their tiny new apartment was a poor substitute for the comfortable home where they'd lived for more than 60 years. And even though they'd grown too frail to do much gardening, the hanging flower basket on their new balcony was nothing like a whole yard with trees, flowers, squirrels, and birds. For a while, we were all miserable. Then the doves moved in. One day, when Dad went out to water the flowers in the hanging basket, a bird was sitting right in the middle of the bouquet. A few days later, in a nest that was little more than a few twigs, two eggs appeared. The doves became our shared obsession. We Googled to learn how long it would take for the eggs to hatch. Mom and Dad spent time every day watching and visiting the doves, a dutiful twosome, who traded egg-sitting time. Soon, Dad could water the plant without disturbing whatever parent happened to be warming the eggs. When they hatched, we were privy to the feeding of the babies, their rapid growth, and their fledging. "One of them is gone," my mother announced one day. By the next day, both had flown. And something else had changed. The little apartment hasn't gotten any bigger, and the roads are still twisty and confusing. The mountains will never be their preferred landscape. But Mom and Dad seem to have nested. Perhaps they've taken a tip from the doves. Home is where you make it, in a flower pot or a house, for a lifetime or for a few weeks. Home is where you go about the business of being a family, and I have come to understand with increasing gratitude that Mom and Dad are here in West Virginia to offer me the privilege of being with my family in these late years of their lives. How perfect that a dove should give me the message, with its mournful voice and peaceful symbolism, with its message of hope, like the dove who brought an olive branch to Noah after the great flood. Can sorrow and peace and hope live in the same heart? I know they can. A little bird told me.
On Thursday, Tucker County clock repairman Doyle Kisner turns 90. For the past 2.5 years, Jessica Caller has been his apprentice and caretaker. Traveling 219 reporter Roxy Todd began visiting the pair in the clock workshop shortly after Jessica began working with Doyle.
Over the next 20 years, most people who still know the art of clock repair will pass away, leaving the world millions of antique clocks in need of regular winding and repair. But in Tucker County, West Virginia, Jessica Caller, a young woman in her 30s, is learning the art of clock repair from 89-year-old Doyle Kisner.
There, it'd be just five, one, two, three, four. You got that right. That's all due till it plays all these tunes out, and then it'll strike over here, see.
I'm learning something that nobody else probably will.
Jessica first met Doyle a few years ago while he was recovering from cancer treatments. She began working with Doyle as an in-home caretaker with the Tucker County Senior Center. When she learned that Doyle was a talented clock repairman and clockmaker, Jessica urged him to start working at it every day. Little by little, Doyle started to get stronger, and meanwhile, Jessica was learning clock repair.
Whenever I came to Doyle, he was skinny and frail, and he wouldn't talk. Now it's just like one part of the family, kind of.
She brought me alive, so that's one good thing I can say about her.
Well, that wasn't me, so that was God.
Down in the basement, Doyle and his apprentice are seated while they work, amidst the chimes of cuckoo clocks and the discordant clash of gongs and bells. Jessica has a small, delicate chain between her fingers. For a few minutes, she's been easing it into an old grandfather clock. Attached to the chain hang the weights that strike the clock's hourly chime. She's giving the old clock its voice back.
You get interested, you don't know what time it is. Time goes so fast. First thing you know, it's 12 o'clock, it's bedtime. You never didn't even know it. That is when you're doing something that you like to do. See, that's the sound.
Doyle remembers the first clock that ever fascinated him. When he was in the 8th or 9th grade, his family was too poor for the kids to get an allowance. And so during the noon hour, while a lot of the other kids would head out to the general stores in downtown Parsons to buy sweets, Doyle usually passed a lot of his time looking in all the windows, alone. One day, as he was looking through one of the windows, he caught a glimpse of an anniversary clock, a very small silver clock with a clear glass dome over the top.
The first clock I remember went round and round. You wind it for once a year on your anniversary. It's all running, one whole year.
It's been over 100 years since Doyle's dad bought the family farm here in 1912. The entire land was covered with forest, and Doyle's parents cleared the land themselves, blasting stumps and hauling the timber out with horses.
Parsons back then, there was a lot of things going on then. I said we had a great fair, and it was right there in Parsons. We were all raised on this farm right here, this farm. You know, we were poor.
Doyle lost his right hand in a farming accident in 1983. Determined to show everyone, including himself, that he wasn't handicapped, Doyle began fixing clocks. He took a special interest in the old broken clocks that other people wanted to throw away. The hobby helped him grow stronger, and it gave him confidence as he learned to live without his right hand.
And he had to learn everything over with his left hand.
It didn't bother me anything. I knew it was bad, but I had to accept it, so, you know, I used to cry over it. It's the way you take it.
Yeah, it's not what you got, it's what you do with it.
Yeah, I can't sit still. I got to figure out everything. I never go to sleep between 3 and 4 o'clock every morning because I got things on my mind.
Well, I got 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 clock, 14.
Today, 15. Doyle is nearing 90 years old. He's been an airplane mechanic, a farm manager, a beekeeper, and he's repaired over 1,300 clocks. Time is what you make of it, I think, considering what Doyle has filled into his 89 years. The air fills with the sounds of 300 antique clocks in Doyle's workshop, marking the slow, steady passage of time.
I got 10 down there right now to work on.
This story was produced by Roxy Todd and the Traveling 219 Project, a production of Allegheny Mountain Radio with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the West Virginia Humanities Council, and AmeriCorps Vista. For more information, visit traveling219.com and Facebook. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. The West Virginia Music Hall of Fame lost another inductee this past week. Homer Bales, the last surviving member of the Bales Brothers, a popular country music group of the 1940s and 50s, died. The four Bales brothers were from Kanawha County and became the first West Virginia act to perform regularly on the Grand Ole Opry. West Virginia Public Radio's Suzanne Higgins spoke to Homer Bales in 2009, following the group's induction into the Hall of Fame.
See that man walking over yonder. See his clothes all ragged and worn. He's led a drunkard's life. Whiskey is the devil in liquid form.
The West Virginia Music Hall of Fame class of 2009 welcomed the Bales brothers, Kyle, Johnny, Walter, and Homer, one of the most popular acts in country music in the 1940s and 50s. 87-year-old Homer is the only surviving brother.
It's very exciting to realize that that my home state has recognized me and called me back. It means a whole lot to me. It means everything.
The Bales brothers were the first West Virginians to star on the Grand Ole Opry. From there, they went to Shreveport as one of the founding acts of the Louisiana Hayride. Despite a rowdy reputation that Homer says was largely deserved, the Bales brothers' songs were often religious in nature, warning of the evils of alcohol.
Strong drink is the devil's greatest weapon.
I would suppose subconsciously we would hope to be causing somebody to see their weakness. Maybe they could overcome it.
The drunkard's grave is a promise for a drunkard. Whiskey is a
The brothers were born into poverty in Kanawha County between 1915 and 1922. They were raised by their mother after their father, a preacher, died.
Our mother got us one of them little cheap Sears Roebuck guitars to sing in churches, sing in revivals, sing in home gatherings, you know, nice places.
Bill Malone is a musicologist and says the Bales brothers always felt indebted to their mother.
They grew up in a very hardscrabble home. Their mother had to raise them, and they have a song called Give Mother My Crown, and that song refers to the attempts to have them adopted by somebody else. It was very hard for the mother to raise them, but she took in washing and she worked for other people. She did everything in her power to keep the family intact and to keep the family fed. And so they always felt strongly about her. I remember hearing them on the radio. They would refer to Mommy Bales, as they called her. She was right there in the studio with them.
If I have a crown coming when the Lord goes around, please, blessed Jesus, give Mother my crown. I didn't realize when I was a lad how great a burden my mother had. Adoption was offered, but Mama said no. She raised us and taught us the right way to go. I want to go to heaven when this life is over. Want to be with Jesus on eternity shore. But if I have a crown coming, when rewards go around, please, blessed Jesus, give Mother my crown.
Dust on the Bible, dust on the Holy Word, the words of all the prophets and the sayings of our Lord. Of all the other books you'll find there's not salvation hope. Get the dust off the Bible and redeem your poor soul.
They were prominent on at least three radio barn dances in the 40s. First in Huntington, West Virginia, then they went to the Grand Ole Opry and were just one of the most popular acts there right at the end of the 40s. And then they went to Shreveport and were among the group that founded the Louisiana Hayride. They were there when Hank Williams came, and they had a lot to do with hiring him to the show. And so they contributed to his rise to fame. They also produced a lot of songs like Give Mother My Crown, Dust on the Bible, and Oh So Many Years That Have Endured in the music. The Everly Brothers, for example, did the song Oh So Many Years, and they spoke frankly about their indebtedness to the Bales Brothers. They learned a lot from their harmony and from their choice of songs.
You know how athletes are today, how the women just go crazy over them? Back then, it was radio people and hillbilly show people. You had to beat the girls off of you at the club, you know?
How did you handle that?
Huh?
How did you handle that?
I just had to run.
Did you run?
It was tough. Most of the time, I got out of it.
The words of all the prophets and the sayings of our Lord.
Following his years on the Louisiana Hayride, Homer Bales became a preacher in Louisiana. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Suzanne Higgins in Beckley.
There's none salvation holds. Get the dust off the Bible and redeem your poor soul.
Homer Bales was born in 1922 near Charleston, West Virginia. He died December 3rd in Ruston, Louisiana. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Petaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky, from Maggie's Music. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia, in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at our new website, wvpublic.org. I'm Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.